Welcome back to the Gains for Girls podcast. Super glad you guys are here. Of course, we have had athletes on the podcast. We have had parents on. I encourage you to go watch the episode with Kim Jones to hear from the perspective of a mom of an athlete who has been impacted by the movement of allowing men into women's sports. We have had coaches on. A few weeks ago, we had Dave and Judy Brown, coaches out in Oregon, who bravely and courageously took a stand and resigned their coaching position after being forced to participate in the farce. But a piece we have been missing is someone actually involved in the NCAA, someone who is willing to stand up to the seemingly undefeatable NCAA. Today's guest is Bill Bock. He was an NCAA official. His story is pretty incredible. He's actually an experienced litigator. He has substantial experience with sports law and sports during drug testing. He was actually the general counsel of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency for 13 years. He's represented clients in high-profile investigations and litigation, including Lance Armstrong. So his expertise and knowledge in the fact of testosterone and how it affects the body, performance-enhancing drugs more broadly, is a valuable one. His story and how he has now left the NCAA is even more important. Make sure you check out the interview here with Bill Bock. Well, Bill, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I kind of just wanted to start by asking you about your interest in sports in general and how you got to where you are now.
I wasn't seeing myself on the field, but always loved sport. We always had whatever sport was in season, either in our family we were playing it or we had it on TV. And so after I got my law degree, I looked around for how I could get involved in supporting athletes. I really loved the Olympics, kind of had five ring fever, loved the whole idea of competition in the Olympics and the motivation, the sacrifice that was made by athletes. And so had the opportunity to support some athletes that had an Olympic dream kind of on their journey, help them with just the navigating fundraising, navigating the rules. As that progressed, I'm in a city that has national governing bodies. In addition to the NCAA, USA Track and Field is in Indianapolis, and other national governing bodies in sport. And so I've had a lot of opportunities over the years to help athletes. And that eventually led to me being involved with the formation of the United States Anti-Doping Agency and serving as USADA's general counsel for 14 years, being involved with a lot of cases and investigations regarding the use of performance-enhancing drugs in sport. Athletes have always, and the need for a level playing field has been a big part of my career.
Yeah. So you got to the USADA. Talk about some of your involvement there. Particularly, I think the most interesting, at least from what I know, is how you litigated on the Lance Armstrong case.
Yeah, absolutely. The Armstrong case was one of the larger cases that we handled. But, things kind of kicked off that USADA opened its doors in 2000. And by late 2002, 2003, we were involved in the Bay Area Laboratory Cooperative case that involved doping by Marion Jones and CJ Hunter and Barry Bonds and others. And I spent a lot of time on that case. But the Armstrong case kind of resulted in part from an investigation of doping and cycling that USADA was involved in for a good 6-8 year period, and both before and after the Armstrong case. Whistleblowers came forward, courageous athletes, some of whom who had used performance enhancing drugs. We were able to sit down with and give them an opportunity to kind of redeem their experience in the sport, to come forward and tell the truth and try and set their sport of cycling back on the right track. And as a result of working with those athletes, we were able to kind of break the so-called omerta, the conspiracy of silence that plagued cycling, where if you stood up, you got beat back down, or you didn't get allowed back into the sport if you talked about doping in the sport. And so it was, you know, it took a while to convince people that that was the right, that honesty was the best policy and that was the right course. We had very courageous young men that had been on Lance Armstrong's cycling team, and they knew, because Lance had demonstrated it, that there was a risk. He was a very powerful individual in the sport, and people lost jobs sometimes. They lost opportunities when they got on the wrong side of him. But ultimately the truth won out, and we had enough witnesses that the outcome was that Lance Armstrong got stripped of his 7 Tour de France titles, but that wasn't the most significant thing. He was surrounded by an entourage of people that had been in the sport for quite a long time, a team director and doctors that were running the doping program. And so we were fortunate to obtain sanctions with the most of his closest doping doctors and the team director, and make sure that those individuals were no longer in a position to continue to dope other athletes. And then from there, we had the opportunity to assist anti-doping agencies in Europe, in a number of countries with their cases, because, as we kept pulling the threads, things kind of unwound. And ultimately there were dozens of cases that went forward, and it gave cycling an opportunity for a new start, a fresh start, a reset. The International Federation got a new president, first time that there had been a contested election and a newcomer from outside the UCI had come in, and a British individual by the name of Brian Cookson took over as the new head of the International Federation. And they established what they called an independent cycling commission that received a lot of evidence and wrote a report and kind of set cycling on a new path. So, that was really what we hoped to see, because we knew that Lance Armstrong didn't start doping in cycling. He and many others profited from it, but it had been going on for a long time. And so it was important not just to pursue a case against Lance Armstrong, but to pursue an effort to really try to clean up the sport and get to the root of some of the problems in the sport.
The contrast now is almost comical. Not too long ago, of course, we had Lance Armstrong's case really setting the precedent, the USADA's involvement in banning performance-enhancing drugs. Now we have the NCAA. When I was in college, we weren't even allowed to drink Celsius, the energy drink, because they said it was a stimulant. But their policy they had in place for 12-ish years was merely 12 months of hormone replacement therapy. And that was enough to mitigate the testosterone advantages that males possessed over females and allowed them to compete in the women's category. So it's almost comical. And so I just kind of wanted to ask you, before we get into the stance that you have now taken with the NCAA and your prior role with the NCAA, what about eligibility has been tested for men? In comparison to women, is there a big contrast there? Of course, I feel like I can see it. But from your perspective, what do you see?
Yeah, Riley, you're absolutely right. When you look at the kind of inequity and discordant way that doping is handled compared to eligibility for a male in the female category. As you say, any amount of a performance enhancing drug, if it's taken by an athlete, shows up in a test. And these are the NCAA's rules, they're USADA's rules, they're rules around the world in sport. If the most minute quantity of prohibited substance is found in an athlete sample, they're found to have committed a rule violation. So there is zero tolerance for any amount of a performance enhancing substance to be in an athlete sample. You know, contrast that with a male in the female category who has an enormous performance advantage. And they have, as you said, just a year of testosterone suppression, which does next to nothing in terms of mitigating the advantage of having a male body, of having enormously higher levels of testosterone through one's entire life, of having, you know, a different gene structure that creates a different anatomy, which allows men to have greater power and strength and speed and endurance, to have larger hearts, you know, tend to be much taller. They have enormous athletic advantages, and we can, you know, talk about the science on that, talk about the statistics on that. But it's there, and we're not enforcing a level playing field like we do in anti-doping when it comes to protecting the female category in sport. And so that's discrimination against women. That's dramatically harmful to women. And it's contrary to the ideal of sport, which should be fair competition.
So it seems simple enough, especially when you explain it like that. But you eventually got involved with the NCAA. You were part of the NCAA committee. So did this issue, the issue of men and women's sports, did this ever come up as an infraction discussion? Did you see any sort of silencing of this issue within the NCAA?
Yeah, I joined the NCAA Division I Committee on Infractions in 2016. And that was really before the issue had arisen in any way that affected sport, kind of to our knowledge. I never, during the period of time that up until just about a week or so ago when I was continued to be on the committee, that issue didn't ever come before the committee. Now, we know now that the reason it didn't come before the committee is that the NCAA's rules have been consistently lax, as have the rules of many other sports organizations, been very lax in terms of protecting women. But it didn't really present as an issue in a big way, I'd say, probably until you experienced it when you competed against formerly Will Thomas, now calling themselves Leah Thomas, started competing in the female category for Penn in 2022.
I want you to talk about what happened a week ago or so, because you have now become a Fox News star. It's been super fun to watch what I've seen, the outpouring of support for you and the stance that you've taken. So tell us about that stance you've taken.
I wrote a letter just about a week ago to Charlie Baker, the president of the NCAA, and to all the members of the NCAA Division I Committee on Infractions, the chair Kay Norton, the managing director of the staff for the committee, Matt McRook, and just everybody that was on the committee, to express to them that I needed to, at this point, resign in protest, because I had, since the Leah Thomas situation had arisen, tried to take my time on the committee to have a lot of conversations with people, to learn more about the NCAA's policies, and also to watch closely its leadership, which transferred from Mark Emmert to Charlie Baker about a year or so ago. And I was very hopeful when Mr. Baker, the former governor of Massachusetts, had assumed the office, because he has a reputation for fairness. And understand that he has a daughter that played high school sports. So I was hoping that there'd be a fresh look at this issue, but it became apparent and is apparent because the rules have only been cosmetically changed, that no change was going to happen. And so the committee I was on is supposed to have been about ethical sport. And what is happening to women is unethical. Well, it's discriminatory. It's, I believe, a violation of Title IX protections for women, but it violates the fundamental tenet of sport, which is competitive fairness. If you don't have competitive fairness, you don't have true sport. And at that point, I realized I needed to just make it very clear that I couldn't continue in that role, given their unwillingness to change those policies.
What was the response, from the NCAA or the other people a part of the NCAA committee you were on?
You know, the response has been, I would say, muted at this point. I've gotten a couple of emails, one from a staff member on the committee and one from a committee member kind of saying, well, we'll miss you at our next meeting. Appreciate your service. And that's nice. But other than that, have not heard from anybody at the NCAA on this issue. And those comments were not on this issue. So that's okay. I didn't take the step to win friends, and didn't necessarily expect that everybody would be happy with the decision. But women are worth standing up for. Clean and true sport is worth standing up for. And so that was a small way in which I had an opportunity to do that. And I think, we all have an opportunity to stand up for women, to stand up for anti-discrimination, and to protect daughters and nieces and women, just by doing what we can to say, this is wrong. We need to give women's opportunities to women. Women's sports is for women. It's not for men, and not for individuals that have biological advantages that can't be replicated by women. So we need to protect women's sport.
It's easier said than done, right? Making those sacrifices and taking a stand. But it's not hard. It's not hard to say something as simple as men and women are different, and each sex deserves to be protected on the basis of our sex, and each sex is deserving of privacy and safety and equal opportunity. That's not hard to say. And so why is it you think that, whether it's the NCAA, whether it's corporate America, whether it's even lawyers, I mean, our government, why do you think people are so hesitant to call males and women's sports out? And really, even broader than that, right? I think a lot of these cultural issues we're seeing, it's kind of like the emperor wears no clothes scenario, where a lot of us are seeing these things happening, but no one's willing to say it out loud. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know if I know all the answers, but I'll give you one thought from what we were talking about earlier in terms of cycling, where there was a conspiracy of silence to protect the cheating that was going on. And it was fear that drove that conspiracy of silence, the so-called omerta. And I think that fear, to a large extent, is driving the policies of the NCAA, driving the actions of university presidents and college athletic directors, fear to stand up for truth and what's right and to protect women. Once we, however, once a few people do stand up, once people take their voice and use it for truth and for what's right, change can be made. And so it didn't take, it took about 7 or 8 whistleblowers in the Armstrong case to bring that case forward after years of a conspiracy of silence. Might take a few more in this case, but if people will stand up and make a stand and say, I can't condone this or support this any longer, I don't care what it costs, I'm going to stand up for truth, then I think we'll see movement on this issue throughout our society, and we'll return to policies that promote women, allow them to triumph, and are good for our wives, our daughters, and our female friends.
For humanity and for God's creation, most importantly. So, Bill, you are just the greatest. You are a part in making that change, a part of being willing to say, no, enough is enough. I'm not going to participate in the farce. And so for that, I know I thank you. I know my future daughter that I hope to have one day, she thanks you. And of course, so many others, young and old, everything in between. We need more bold people like yourself to make a change. Because like you said, truth and sanity, it'll always prevail. It always does. It's just a matter of how long we allow the theatrics to continue on before truth and sanity do prevail. But in the meantime, here we are. And I'm glad and honored really to be in this fight with you. So thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Riley. Thank you for your leadership. Thank you for having a strong voice for women. And I agree with you. I think you'll be back on the podium soon, as we'll be celebrating women's opportunities being increased over what they are right now.
Bill is the perfect display of a principled man with integrity. And we certainly need more of those. Our country is lacking of those. Thanks for tuning in today. We are super glad you're here. We hope to see you next time. Make sure you like and comment and subscribe anywhere where you get your podcasts. Check us out at outkick.com. You see my shirt here. It says Crush Evil. This is actually from the Covenant Rescue Group. This is a group based in Alabama. They do statewide missions as well as global missions in stopping child sex trafficking and child exploitation. I encourage you to go to their website, covenantrescuegroup.com. Any ways you can support them, it is crucial. Of course, we spend a lot of time on this podcast talking about the impact of a lot of these cultural issues and how they affect women, but understand our most vulnerable are being attacked, and that's the children. So thank you guys, and we will see you next week.